Hello, and welcome to Motorpod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 579 for the 4th of October 2018. And on this show, we're going to be covering a few choice news items, a quick review of round 11 of the World Superbike Championship, which was from Magny-Cours in France, and also round 11 of the Bennett British Superbike Championship from the TT Circuit in Assen. And joining me from the UK is Mr. Dave Neil.
Hello, Andrew. How are you, mate?
Very good, thank you. Thank you very much for stepping in and helping us. So we're just going to do a quick run through some news, some World Superbike stuff, and then we can get on to the real good meat and potatoes, which was the British Superbike Championship from Assen. And we had a pretty eventful weekend at Assen.
Yeah, there's plenty gone on. There's an awful lot to talk about through the show, what happened at Assen with the British Superbike boys. Big twist in the tail through the second race, and quite a drama-filled second race, at least. First race was exciting. It was good. The front three were pretty close together, but the second race was where all the drama was. So that's something we'll come to in the next half an hour or so. But we need to start off with some news.
Well, I think the best news that we got this week to start with is the fact that two kind listeners put their hands in their pockets and help support us. Warren Pon and Keith Kovac, thank you very much. Kind donators this week. Thanks very much for showing your support. We really do appreciate that. And yes, we do have some news. There's a little bit of MotoGP news that, from my standpoint, caught my eye. And that is confirmation that Jordi Torres will make his second MotoGP appearance in Thailand this weekend with the Real Avintia Ducati. He had a pretty impressive debut, I thought, to Aragon, to finish only, 0.6, I think he was, from his teammate, Javier Simeon, which is pretty impressive when you think that Javier had bumped up to the GP17 and not the GP16. So you kind of wonder if Torres, who might be struggling for ride on the MV Augusta and World Superbikes next year, might not be getting a job with MotoGP next year.
I think that would be worth seeing. The guy clearly has talent, the Spanish Elvis himself. He's proven himself time and time again, even on inferior machinery, that he has the talent to take himself further forward than he already is. Difficult in World Superbikes with the major rides already being tied up, so there isn't much of a solid future for him then. And as we know from the UK scene and from the World Superbike and World Supersport scene, the MV Augustas, when they work, they're a great bike, but they don't work often enough, and that's really thwarted Jordi Torres's progress this season. Talented rider. I like the guy, and he brings a little bit of colour to the proceedings as well. So it's good for him to get the second ride. Yeah, great display at Assen. Got Assen on the brain. At Aragon. So, yeah, well deserved. I think that's one to watch for this coming weekend.
Yeah, and we'll have to see. No news that I've seen whether MV Augusta will be back in the World Superbike paddock next year. Obviously, they're taking on a new challenge with their role in Moto2, and I'm wondering if that won't be their primary form of promotion and maybe just stepping back from World Superbike for next year. As yet, no news. We'll have to see.
With a new rider to find as well.
The other little piece of MotoGP news was, unfortunately, Danny Kent looks like he's lost his ride with the Speed Up team. They have officially confirmed that Edgar Pons, that up-and-coming star, will replace Danny Kent at this week's tie round of the Moto2 World Championship.
More news on Danny Kent later in the show.
From World Superbike, we have a few little bits of news. There was definitely some rumours about who will be going where for 2019. Nothing definitive, but one of the big news events that we had was the fact that Ana Carrasco had gone on to win the FIM Supersport 300 World Championship at 21 years old, becoming the first female to secure a world title in the final race of the season at Magny-Cours. She had a pretty tough race. She qualified 25th, definitely had some technical issues, I from what I understand, with the suspension, but a pretty impressive race, fought her way back up to 13th, and ultimately won the championship by 1 point.
As long as she wins the championship, that's all that matters. It could be by 1 point, it could be by 10. It's great to see it, and a lot of it, if we can encourage more girls into the sport, more females, then all the better. And this is the best way to do it, to show that it can be done. And Ana Carrasco's done a fantastic job this year. The Supersport 300 is very tightly contested. Scott DeRue, he's no mug, who's been at the forefront most of the season. He's a former Moto3 GP rider, former British Motostar champion. So, you know, he's been around a little bit, kind of fell off the radar after winning his British Motostar Championship, ended up in stock six, but didn't really take on the role of the bigger bike too well. Ended up in Supersport 300 and really ran Anna Carrasco close to the title. The guys there in the Supersport 300 class, she's won it by talent. You know, nobody stood back and said, after you, there's been no red carpet, anything like that. In fact, quite the opposite, where the boys will do. It's the same in any sport, isn't it? If you have, and this isn't the sexist view in any way, shape or form, to them, she's another rival. But you're not telling me that there's the fact that she's female will also spur them on as well.
Yeah, hard to say. I just think they see someone in leathers and a helmet in front of them, and it's just, you know, most riders are just like hounds chasing foxes. If they see someone in front of them, they just want to close them down and pass them. I don't think they think too much about anything more than that. So it'll be great to see, because Anna's going to be staying in Supersport 300 to defend her title in 2019 as well. So that was some good news for the weekend. There was some other news as well, talking about the European Super Stock 1000 Championship. That will cease at the end of this year. Marcus Reiterberger took the title, sealing the end of the last ever European Superstock Championship. My hope, I think this makes sense. I'm hoping too that now that with the Superstock thousands gone, there's, you know, a possibility to slightly dumb down, reduce, I don't know, the superbikes themselves. I don't know if we'll have some of the top Superstock teams potentially moving up to compete on the superbike grid. It feels like I know some people were complaining about the loss, but it seems like one of those things that, you know, you kind of cut back, you prune something for the health of the plant. And I feel like this kind of setting up the next year or two in a good way.
See, I'm of the other persuasion to this. I think that the Superstock has a benefit in the same way that Superstock has a benefit in BSB. It's a massive jump from a supersport machine to a full-fledged superbike, especially at world level.
The difficulty, I think, though, is don't forget, this is a European round, so they're only running the European tracks. And they kind of have this issue where they had a superbike championship in CEV, which then got spun out into a European superbike championship. And there's too much overlap, there's too many competing. So I think this allows them to now have potentially that other European Superbike Championship grow a little bit more. And, you know, I think my ultimate hope is that as the superbikes themselves get cheaper and hopefully more in line with national championships, that when you have superbikes land in France, land in the UK, land in Asia, wherever, you have the ability to have a lot more wildcards come and compete, hopefully on, you know, their national machinery that can still be competitive and comply with the rules. It would be great to see if the organizers could include some prize money for the wildcards as well, because I'm sure that is something that would help them back in their national series as well. But these are the types of things I think could really help with the vibrancy of superbikes going forwards in the next 4 or 5 years, you know, where you have local champions taking part in wildcard rides, demonstrating, showing what they can do, bringing the locals to the circuit to watch this. That, I think, for me, is kind of where I'd hopefully end up they're going. I don't know if that is the game plan. I'm sure if it's necessarily been revealed to us what the ultimate game plan is, but this feels like a step in that direction.
Interesting thoughts. It just seems it's a difficult one, because each national series has a different set of rules. So maybe to bring the rules closer together across the board. I know obviously in British Superbikes they run the Motec electronics, no rider aids. So they have to run Magneti Marelli electronics and put everything back on for such when Jake Dixon. Now, this is something I'm not 100% sure of. I need to look into this because I'm not going to guess. I can't remember if when Jake Dixon did his wild card at World Superbikes, whether he carried the standard BSB Motec or whether he changed the electronics. to...
For some reason, I think he had the standard BSB.
Yeah, I do, now I think about it. Which obviously is a bus ride away from the electronics that the guys are using in World Superbikes currently. The most incredible, sophisticated electronics you could wish for against no rider aids.
I think, though, this is part of my mind of how we can... make superbikes slightly less technical, more affordable, is to take away some of that complexity. For example, if you think about Moto2 had no rider aids or electronics, they've gone to a simplified standardized package. And yeah. I wonder if that isn't the sort of happy medium, looking at the Moto2 level of electronics.
This is nothing new. This is nothing that hasn't been discussed across the motorcycle world as we speak. But what there is to do, we could dedicate a whole show.
We will. We'll have the time, I think, as the racing finishes up and we start to roll into the winter season. I think maybe that'll be a challenge. You and I will go off into different corners of the room. We'll sit down and we'll come up with the ultimate World Superbike Championship, rules, specifications, everything.
I think that's a great idea. Steve English, if you're listening to this, give me a call, mate, please.
Yeah. Hang on a minute. You can't have Zonahan
call in the heavy
hitters. Oh, my God. One thing I did want to shout, just going back to the Supersport 300 race, we had an interview by Scott Bolton last week with the Canadian Alex Dumas. He finished 25th in the Supersport race, so congratulations to him. Go Habs. The last section of news we'll do some BSB news and then we'll sort of start getting into the racing. One of the things that we saw was a provisional 2019 calendar unveiled for British Superbikes next year. I was happy to see that Brands Hatch Indy, the little circular roundabout that they've been trying to race around, is now gone. Two rounds at Donington Park. There'll be the national and the international.
Indeed.
Is that what they call the big one?
Yeah, the GP circuit, yeah.
And I think of what I saw too with the success of Silverstone National, they'll be keeping that.
Another great move.
I know. So it's looking like a pretty decent calendar, I think, for next year. I think some of the timings have changed as well.
Yeah, it's a little later starting in the year. I think it's still Easter weekend that it starts, but it's... the third weekend of April, something like that. But there are no back-to-back rounds this year. And also, the first Donington round is at the start of TT week. At the start of TT fortnight. So that Donington round, which I think is 24th, 25th, 26th of May. I haven't got it in front of me. Something like that. The very last weekend of May, which in the UK is a bank holiday. They're actually doing the Friday, Saturday and Sunday, not the Monday. Whereas at Alton Park 3 weeks prior, they will be doing the bank holiday Monday, as is traditional. Incidentally, that round, that weekend, the last weekend of May, the bank holiday weekend, has traditionally, for the past few years, that was World Superbikes. So the World Superbike calendar hasn't been produced yet. So whether there is going to be a British round of World Superbikes, I would hope that there is. I don't see any reason why not, apart from dwindling attendances. But that weekend is usually for World Superbikes. So I think World Superbikes will have to rejig their calendar. That's MSV saying, we want that date, we're booking that in first. And then we know there's no love lost between MSV and Dorna. Whether that was a deliberate move by MSV to move World Superbikes to later in the year, we'll have to wait and see, but it certainly makes the calendar a lot more fluid without the six-week road racing break that we've had for the last umpteen years to allow the teams to go off to the Northwest 200 and then to the TT to then come back and go to Knockhill or Snetterton, whichever the first round is post roads break. So it's a good move by Stuart Higgs and his team. I really like the look of the calendar. Everything has a break in between it. For potential Grand Prix refugees coming in and guys coming in from different championships, losing Brands Indy is no biggie. I think to every man in the championship, losing Brands Indy is no loss. It's been difficult. It's gone the same way as Mallory Park in the fact that it was just the laps are too short. There's too many on track at the same time, and it's becoming unsafe. And one thing that Stuart Higgs prides himself on is safety. Whether it's the race safe marshals that line the circuit, the national championship is one of the best. All the marshals across the world do a fantastic job. But you watch the British marshals at their best, and you know they're without equal. So to see the championship move from Brands Hatch Indy up to Donington Park National Circuit, so down the back straight, turn left, not right. So we just do a little, turn right, not left. I will get that right. So you have the S's in a slightly different place further down, as the old circuit used to do before they got the GP back in 97, which is why the loop was put in to take the track up to 2.5 miles, which was GP standard. So yes, it's going to be a slightly shorter lap for the national, but again, it'll make for closer racing. And rather than having the S's that have been elongated as you turn left through the foggy S's, to turn right through the national S's, it's a lot tighter, it's cambered slightly differently, and it's the run to the line. So in the same sense that they've done Silverstone as a national circuit, I think moving Donington to a national circuit for one round should throw up some fantastic racing.
We mentioned Danny Kent, unfortunately having been let go by Speed Up from in the Moto2, but it sounds like he was actually at Assen and talking to the Moto... Oh God, I'm never going to pronounce this properly.
Mavuno.
He was talking to the Mavuno.
He was talking to Colin Wright, who runs the Mavuno.com Halsall Racing Suzuki team. And I'd seen on social media prior to the weekend that he was heading out there with his brother and with Fraser Rogers. So I kind of anticipated something may come from this weekend. And then a little bit of a word came through that Chrissy Rouse had been stood down. I can't say he was sacked or released or what. I don't know.
Well, I think he's still injured.
He is still injured. Had he done FP1 and FP2? He didn't go out in qualifying. But he was quite well off the pace. And I think they've basically rested, in inverted commas, rested Chrissy for the rest of the season. They weren't expecting that, because there was a tweet from Steve Brogan saying, well, didn't expect to be on the boat on the way home this early. And Steve Brogan is the mentor for Chrissy Rouse, the ex-British Superstock runner and British Superbike rider. Yeah, there's been one or two goings on there. It's a difficult one for Martin Halsall's team, because they got rid of Tommy Bridewell and they brought in Chrissy Rouse, and then now Chrissy Rouse is gone and they're potentially bringing in Danny Kent. The news is that they're going to offer Danny, or they have offered Danny, a test on the Suzuki to see what his level is ahead of the British Superbike round there in a week and a half's time, as it's coming up. So I think they can give special dispensation. MSV can give special dispensation, because the ruling is that you're not allowed to test at any circuit within 7 days of racing there. However, Joe Francis tested at Alton Park the week leading up to the previous round for the P&R BMW team. And there may be, unless they put something together this week, they may allow him to test next week ahead of the weekend's action, just to see his level. He's only ever ridden GP prototypes, the stiff framed, you know, the ones without the hinge in the middle almost. I know that the superbikes these days are quite braced frames. They're not quite as spongy as they used to be, but it's not a rigid Moto2 or Moto3 bike. So it's going to, and the tyres, the Pirellis are different, and the electronics are different as well, to be it from the Moto2, as we said, to move to one without. But I don't think the KTMs, do Moto3s have, they don't have traction control and thing, do they?
No.
I didn't think they did. So he's used to riding without it, so that'll be a benefit for him. It's not one where he's come from MotoGP where it's crack open the throttle and let the electronics do the rest. His mind isn't going to have to calibrate too much to be able to get his head around it. It's just the size of the bike, the different lines. And, you know, if he can be somewhere within the top 20, I think that would be, you know, a reasonable return for him should he get the opportunity to do it.
Yeah, so we'll see. I think, my understanding is they were trying to set up a test so that he could take the opportunity to ride at Brands. It feels like it's a bit of a job interview, potentially for next year.
Absolutely, I would say so.
So we'll see how it goes. And you would think Stuart Higgs, you know, would love to have a brand name. The interest that would create having him on the grid, whether he's at the front or at the back, I think would create a lot of interest for the last three races at Brands.
Sure. And if you look at the guys that have come in previously, Sylvain Guintoli was a failure. Davide Giuliano was a failure. So
it's a bit harsh, Dave. I mean, you know, failure. I mean, how did you find that? It just maybe didn't go quite as well as he planned.
Was go on, keep going.
Less fast than everybody else.
Yep.
Didn't quite perform as expected.
So therefore?
It was maybe not a complete success. There is no way, a nice way of saying it, really.
There isn't. There really isn't. No, and that does, you know, they're all faster than me. But when you see a World Superbike champion coming in and finishing, you know, struggling to get into the points, and a World Superbike front runner, unfortunately, he was injured at Brands Hatch. But before that, he was off the pace anyway.
Okay, well, let me ask you this then. How about if I took a MotoGP rider and put them on, I don't know, a Ducati for next year? How do you fancy that?
I think that sounds a great idea. Anybody in mind?
I know. I think I'd team him, if it was me, I'm just saying if this is me, I would team him with a rather temperamental Australian gentleman.
Ooh, that's contentious.
Put that into the mix. On a brand new, untested bike. How does that sound?
I think that's a great idea. Do you reckon we'll see that happen?
Recipe for success for next year?
It's a recipe for something.
I think we're hinting at the fact that it seems that Josh Brooks and Scott Redding will be confirmed as 2019 riders for Paul Bird Motorsport, riding the new Ducati V4. I think by the time this airs, it will be news over social media, so I don't think we're spoiling anything.
It came out over social media as a spoiler anyway, which is why we're feeling the need to talk about it. I think it's been rumoured that Scott Redding's been coming over to BSB for a while now, so it's not a huge surprise to see. He's been doing a little bit of teasing on his Instagram account. Do you think I'd look good on this bike, which was Jake Gagne's 45 in World Superbike on the Honda, the Red Bull Honda World Superbike team? And would I look good on this bike or this bike? As far as I'm aware, it's a done deal and ready to be announced. So by the time the show goes live, Scott Redding should be announced as one of the riders for Paul Bird Motorsport. But Colin Wright, in his infinite wisdom, played a blinder today. When Kawasaki UK announced that there was a new rider for Bournemouth Kawasaki last week, Paul Bird cheekily replied to them, Glenn Irwin, for everybody to see, which kind of really blew their candle out a little bit, as you know, as is the way with British Superbikes. They like to build up. There's always rumour and social media, and usually it gets leaked out beforehand anyway, but not everybody gets to see it. So there is still the element of surprise. Not everybody delves into things as deeply as either myself or Harry, and other guys who we have a little network of people that we know. And it's one of those where, yeah, it's pretty obvious that Scott's come in. But yeah, so Colin Wright came out today and said, yeah, it's Brooks and Scott Redding at PBM next year. Sorry, Paul, but just getting you back for what you did to Kawasaki. So Colin Wright, he really doesn't care. So yeah, neither of which at this point of time of recording the show are confirmed. Hopefully Scott Redding will be confirmed tomorrow. I suspect Josh Brooks will be confirmed at a later date. Rumour had been around for a while that he was looking. There was a little bit of history between Paul Bird and through Josh Brooks, but I think they both swallowed their pride and put on a professional front. And that's going to be, should that be confirmed, a really strong team. So with Brooks, I've got the list of potentials further down on my extensive British Superbike notes. One person, as you listen to the commentary as keenly as I do across the BSB weekend, there were one or two little nuggets given away Shaky gave away that Taran McKenzie has re-signed for Macam Yamaha for next season, which I don't think has been officially announced yet. So he put that one out there. Also, Jamie Whittam, he mentioned that that Jason O'Halloran was in the frame for the McCams ride after they discussed the prospect of Josh Brooks moving on. So I think that, for me, is potentially the next move that we'll see, that will to see Jason O'Halloran go to McCams, which for me is a fantastic move for Jason. He's been a loyal servant to Honda. It's now time for him to show what he can do on another manufacturer. Honda haven't quite given him the tools for the job. He knows the Yamaha is good enough for podiums weekend in, weekend out. And I think for me, along with Taran McKenzie, he's one of the dark horses for the championship for next season.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair point. I would agree with you that you know, Jason and Dan as well. I think, you know, Honda, the team themselves, have done as much as they can with that machinery, but you know, there's a limit, there's a line. Without further help coming to them from sort of higher up, closer to the factory, I don't see them making any progress for that. So there's no question that both of them are very, very talented riders. So it's great to see that, yeah, he's got potentially a top line ride for next year.
I mean, the Honda, it is still quintessentially a factory Honda, but they don't seem, and similar to World Superbikes, they just don't seem to be able to get the consistency and the front-running pace that the factory Kawasaki has, the factory Yamaha, and the factory Ducati.
It feels like it's a 2015 factory Honda, or 2016. It just doesn't feel like a bang-up-to-date 2018, 2019 bike.
No, you would hope it would be challenging for the top five, top three, not sort of the top six that Jason can do on a regular basis. Dan's had a hell of a year, which we'll come to later on, which has just been compounded this weekend. So they've had, and obviously Jason's had an awful lot of injuries, and he's been unlucky as well. The whole team, after trying to get that bike working the whole of last season, to then trying again this season, it just hasn't fallen into place for the Louth-based team. So we'll have to see what comes there. It'd be interesting to see who they pull in if they do lose Jason and potentially Dan, or if they just lose one. So the British Superbike silly season has only just started. There's an awful long way to go yet, because I'm not even sure what's going to happen at Tyco BMW. I think there's going to be shuffles there as well. I could see Christian Hidden maybe moving on. I think Michael Laverty wants one more season in the championship. James Ellison, I think, will retain, as we said on the show last week. He will stay for another year, I think. So, you know, there's still plenty of scope for movement yet between the riders. An awful lot of talented riders out there. But the number of worthy seats, you know what I'm trying to say? To suit their standards, the seats are running out.
You can definitely point to teams that are likely to win one or two individual races or one or two rounds. But if you start to, you know, try and list the teams that are consistently there as a top three, top five finishers, weekend in, weekend out, that's a pretty short list.
Yeah, it is. It is. And then you look at Lee Hardy as well. If Lee Hardy runs again next year, is he going to look at youth? Would they take a gamble on someone like Ryan Vickers maybe?
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, there's an awful lot of potential to be seen. So we shall report back as and when these seats fall into place. But there's an awful lot of mileage in the British Superbike silly season just yet.
Well, before we get on to the big races at Assen, let's just have a quick whip through World Superbike. Did you happen to catch any of the World Superbike action from France?
Sadly not. Sadly not. Would you do the honours?
We all know that Johnny Ray was poised to take the championship if he could just get the win in the first race, and he did. He did just that after a pretty impressive, dominant race. Tom Sykes had actually pulled pole position by a 0.1 of a second. Johnny Ray had to start in second, but once the race got underway, Sykes, I think, managed to hold the lead for about one lap before Johnny Ray got into the lead, and then he was off, head down, just doing exactly what he wanted to do. There was a few other good rides. Javier Forres was looking pretty good on the Barney Racing Team Ducati in third. Unfortunately, Alex Lowes went down early at turn 15, and another non-finisher was Michael Ruben Rinaldi. He went out early too with an engine seize on a Ducati, imagine that. Pretty lucky escape. He managed to just keep it upright through most of the gravel, just tumbling at the end, and was uninjured. I think most of the best action in race one, to be honest, was more mid-pack, watching Razgatioglu fighting with Vandermark before he got away, and then Malandri and Baz, who was obviously racing at his home Grand Prix, so he had an extra half a second motivation. Adelaide is the main hairpin at the end of the main straight, and that was really the main passing point, so it was just watching people go under each other on the brakes. But it was Jonny Rea who went on to win. That meant that's his fourth title in a row, equaling Carl Fogarty's record. I think it's now his 67th victory. And obviously Kawasaki went on to take the manufacturer's championship. Race two, in some respects, was just another demonstration of his great speed. He started back down in ninth on the grid, was up to fourth by lap one, had an early fight with Davis, who was still riding injured with a damaged collarbone. Pretty impressive performance by him. He kept the lead for some time. It wasn't until a lap 11 until Jonny Rea was able to squeeze past at the 180. And then again, he just put the hammer down and pulled away. And for the most of that race, I think the leaders were pretty much strung out. Again, the main racing action was back mid-pack with Razgatioglu, Loris Baz, and Laverty. Unfortunately, he didn't have a great race one. So that meant that was now Rea's 68th victory, 131 podiums, which meant that was now one more than Troy Corsa. If you look at the championship with Jonny Rea having sealed the deal, it's really now coming down to Chas Davis in second and Michael Vandermark some 26 points behind. Sykes with a slightly better weekend than some other weekends he's had. Managed to pull back a few points. He's only 36 points behind Vandermark. They've got two more rounds to go. Two races at Argentina at the new circuit El Rilicum, and then after that they go on for the final round in Qatar. And I think we might have Martin out there in Qatar. So with a little bit of luck, we might have a few interviews from him as well. The Argentinian circuit looks like it will actually be complete. There's been some photographs and stuff to say that, you know, the track's all down. Sounds like it's got the sign off, so racing should be ready to go in the 2 weeks time. I guess it'll be a week and a bit by the time this comes out. That's the 12th to the 14th of October.
Same weekend as Brands British Superbikes. So another Superbike Sunday for everybody's enjoyment.
Yeah, and with the Argentinian round and the time difference, you should be able to sort of watch British Superbikes during the day, go out for the pub, have a bit of a meal, come back, and then catch the Argentinian race in the evening.
Sounds like a plan. If I'd have watched the World Superbike as well this weekend, it would have been the weekend too full of racing, I think, for my liking.
I think, honestly, especially given the fact that British Superbikes were at Assen, the TT circuit there, the Cathedral of Speed, I think really that was the race to watch. And even more so because they actually had some sunny weather for the weekend.
Yeah, they did, which was great to see. I mean, normally it's not too bad over... if you hear some creaking, my apologies.
It's your back.
It's, yeah. Your I was doing yoga last night. My back doesn't creak anymore. I was yoga-ing with Jennifer last night before I came home today, so...
I'm sorry, you were oogling last night?
Yoga-ing.
Oh, yoga-ing. Sorry, I thought you said oogling.
No. If you've seen the exchange of tweets on Twitter, no, I wasn't oogling whatsoever. Yes. Brian is a lovely girl.
Okay.
The yoga teacher. She's very, very good, but most of the time I'm spending trying not to break wind, burp, or fall over. Far too busy to do any ogling whatsoever. Yes, Assen, and down to sort of my special. Thank you for the World Superbike recap, mate. Much appreciated on that one. It is a difficult one, as we said earlier on, but fair play to Jonny Rea. He's breaking records left, right, and centre. And I do recall seeing that somebody had taken a screen grab at some point. Looking at his consistency lap by lap is something really impressive. He's not coasting.
He was 137s the whole race one.
Yeah, incredible.
It was just so incredibly consistent. I mean, it was just unbelievable.
Within sort of half a second across the whole race almost. It's unerring confidence and ability in that machine that he has. So, yeah, hats off to him. A lot of people are knocking World Superbike at the moment. It's a difficult one, but, you know, Johnny's riding the best he's ridden on the machine that's made for him. He fits that machine like a glove. It's up to the other manufacturers to step up to a certain point and really close that gap, whether it be Yamaha, whether it be Ducati. Change of riders across the board. Will Bautista make a big difference when he comes in next season? It'll remain to be seen. Be nice to see Honda back up there. I know Chris Pike and the guys there are working as hard as they can with the tools that they have. So it would be nice to see a little bit more. And one of the main things I've seen from World Superbike this weekend is, as I was coming south down the A1 today, the three Milwaukee Aprilia trucks were heading north up to Gisborough, back to base. So that was the closest I've been to World Superbikes this weekend.
Yeah, and there are some rumours floating around. I think these are things that we can talk about maybe in future shows when they start to solidify a little bit to know which riders are going to be riding for Milwaukee next year and what manufacturer they're going to be with as well. But like I say, I think we'll leave that for a later show as these things start to solidify a little bit more. Let's talk about qualifying for British Superbikes.
Qualifying for British Superbike, it was quite a hectic little affair. Friday had been a decent day, as you said, weather-wise. There was no issues all weekend with the weather at all, apart from slightly cooler temperatures, which left sort of the track surface all weekends. The later into the afternoon that you got, it was on the cusp of whether to use the SC0 or whether to use the SC1. The SC0 being the softer compound, the 1 being the slightly harder compound. And there's a certain track temperature where the 0 just doesn't quite work. So it needs the warmer track temperatures to work and to be at its most effective, the SC1 being the more durable of the two.
Just remind me, did the teams get a set allocation of each of the compounds for the entire weekend?
Good question. Don't know.
I'm just wondering if this is something where, you know, you're always caught a little bit trying to think, okay, well, this is what we want to race on, so we want to keep at least, you know, a set or two of those nice and fresh, but at the same point, we have to get through qualifying, so it's always a bit of a gamble.
Qualifying invariably is done on a zero, invariably, because Pirelli don't provide a qualifying tyre, and it's only sort of 15 minutes, 10 minutes, and 7 minutes, something like that. Across the three qualifying sessions, it's almost always done on an SC0. There may be somebody who will throw in a hard every now and again just to, if they feel that their bike can run that pace, but invariably it tends to be the softer SC0 that's run for qualifying time.
Yeah, maybe like the fast runners in the early qualifying can get away with the harder ones and just kind of leave the really good ones for Q3.
Absolutely true. That's something I'll look into next time I'm chatting with one of the guys who will look after that side of things. On Friday, there was a couple of names at the top of the charts that we hadn't seen there before. OMG Racing Suzuki's Gino Rea, he topped FP1 and was second in FP2. So he was really quick straight out of the gates at Assen. A circuit he's been to many, many times before. A circuit he's ridden a 1000cc motorcycle around before when he rode for the junior Tenkate Honda team. I think in the Dutch Superbike Championship he did a handful of rounds. So he knew his way around Assen on a 1000cc machine. So for the first time this year, he actually was arriving on the front foot to concentrate on machine setup, not actually to understand which way the track goes.
And that, to my mind, suggests they seem to have a good base setting now with that bike.
Yeah, they've definitely got the bike in the window for him. That's a fact. He spent an awful lot of time this year trying to work hard to get a base setting that will work for him. Again, coming from lighter machines, slightly smaller machines, he has a different riding style to a lot of the guys in the championship. So it was nice to see Gino up at the front, up at the sharp end. He was hotly pursued by James Ellison in the top three on Friday as well. There was rumours that he'd changed from KTEC suspension to Ohlins.
I think it was more than rumours. I think it was definite.
It had been it had been confirmed. I couldn't find where that had been confirmed.
My understanding was that he was on Olin's and happy to be back.
Yeah, no, we'd spoken about that before, hadn't we? That he really struggled with the K-Tech, and he had Olin's at GB Moto, and he's had Olin's wherever he's been, whether it be Milwaukee, Yamaha, GB Moto. It's always worked for him, so... Yeah, it's good to see him back on that. Didn't really help him across the course of the weekend, unfortunately, but it certainly made for a great Friday for James Ellison, that's for sure. Now, FP3 on Saturday morning, this is the one where everybody kind of finds their race pace more than anything, and then has the bike ready and set for the qualifying session later on in the afternoon. You can have your bike set if you bring it back. Unfortunately for Tommy Bridwell, he had a huge off round the back of the circuit. Thankfully, getting away with just a cut finger and some quite sore muscles and some bruises as he rolled through the kitty litter did I see somewhere it was 188 kilometres an hour that his crash happened at as the bike let go?
Yeah, unfortunately at Assen, I don't think there are any slow crashes.
Yeah, it's one of those places that you don't really want to crash anywhere if you can help it. And that was something that was that appeared to be something over the weekend. The attrition rate wasn't particularly high. So that was something that was good for the weekend. It wasn't a high crash rate over the weekend. The weather obviously had something to do with that as well, with it being warmer, the track warmer, and guys have been there on numerous occasions. So, yeah, that was good to see. But unfortunately for Tommy Bridwell, yeah, he injured yet another finger. I think he's only got, 7.5 fingers or 8.5 fingers left. So he could do without damaging any more. But unfortunately for Steve Moore and the Motorrapido team, the Ducati Panigale came back, I think, mostly in a wheelbarrow, which was, tough for the guys to deal with. But they managed to get him ready and get him out into Q1. So that was a rare feat of engineering excellence for Will's team. So congratulations to those guys for turning the bike round in what was... What, about 4 hours, something like that, maybe that sort of time frame. Kudos to all of the teams in BSB that have to rebuild motorcycles and get them back out in time with limited amount of issues and bugs to iron out. First up on the Q1, the usual suspects were always going to be there. It was always going to be one for the lower ranks in Q3. We lost. Let's have a look. Who did we lose? We lost Aaron Zanotti. We lost Sean Winfield, Joe Francis, Fraser Rogers, Martin Jessup, Dean Harrison, Josh Elliott making his debut for OMG Racing Suzuki on the Superbike, Mason Law, Sylvain Barrier. Danny Buchan, he crashed at the end of Q3 and couldn't, unfortunately, he'd qualified for Q2, but unfortunately they couldn't get the bike back and rebuilt ready for Q2, unfortunately, for the lanky Essex man. He had to make do with 18th place as you go through into Q2. Jake Dixon set the fastest time, but which invariably is slightly irrelevant, apart from, because he's well inside the top 20, but apart from the fact that he'd bettered Shane Burns' lap record of 135.7 only by a hundredth of a second. But that was the pace that they were running. So it was a seriously hot pace throughout the whole of the three qualifying sessions. He upped the pace again to a 135.5 in Q2. Leon Haslam just 0.1 behind him, ahead of Glenn Irwin. Luke Mossy, he was down in 17th. Difficult times for the other JG Speedfit rider. That, you know, talent doesn't fade overnight. The guy can ride, there's no doubt about that. But I think there's something going on in the team and with him that just is really affecting his riding at the moment. And I don't expect to see him in the team next season. There's talk on the TV that that they've signed who have they signed? They've signed Ben Curry. The word that they said on the commentary across the weekend. So Luke Mossy's certainly looking for a ride for next season. So he's another one that's out there. looking for one of those sort of top half of the field seats that are becoming less and less available, it seems. Bradley Ray, he was another one. He was down in 16th place. No, not at all where Bradley Ray should be, or the build-based Suzuki. That, you know, that you'd expect them to be firmly ensconced inside the top 10. But running 16th really isn't where Bradley Ray or Luke Mossy in 17th should be. Coming to the end of the session, Gino Rea, he crashed out on his last flying lap, two corners from the end. Funniest thing, I don't know if he had an airbag that was two sizes too big for him, but he was massive when he came off that. Invariably, you can see when somebody's airbag's gone off because they do change shape, obviously. We all know that. We've all seen it. But this one on Gino's, I don't know whether he uses two charges of air in his or whether it's just the one, but it just seemed to inflate him massively. And he couldn't, his hands were flopping as he was walking, and he immediately had to reach for his leathers to release the pressure on the zip, because I think he was struggling to breathe.
And then I don't know which system he uses, because I think really there's two systems, which is the Dainese and the Alpine Stars Tech Air, and both of them have sort of been developed. I have the Dainese one, and that starts off with just an airbag around the collarbone and the upper body,
yeah.
But that's been extended now down, I think, to the ribs, and I'm not sure if they've also included like the pelvic basin as well.
Okay.
I think maybe the Tech Air one is a little bit more all-encompassing, and then that technology, I think, has been licensed out to other suit manufacturers for them to use. So, you know, it could be a development of one of those where it's like the full, not just the shoulders, but you're right, you know, sort of down past the ribs, you know, right down into the
basin. Yeah, it was
too.
There's a big one.
There's a great shot. He almost looks like some sort of superhero photographer caught him sort of just standing there, all sort of swollen, everything like that. But the main thing is just to see that he was back on his feet, that obviously the suit and the airbag did its job, and he was all right and able to waddle back to the pits.
He was, unlike his motorcycle, needed a full rebuild.
I was just wanted to go back to, you talked about Bradley Ray down there in 16th,
yeah.
But unfortunately his teammate Richie Cooper was only sort of 15th. I mean, he was only about, you know, a tenth of a second ahead. So for them in qualifying, that just seemed to be about the best that build-based Suzuki could bring.
Yeah, and I think that hits the nail on the head, really. It's the best that the bike can do.
So then if you look at Gino up in 11th, you know, another sort of 0.3 quicker than that. Seems that's a pretty impressive demonstration of what he was able to do with the Suzuki.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's certainly not a lot wrong with the Suzuki that he's riding. But for some reason, the Hawk Racing guys, the build-based Suzuki, they really have lost their way with the GSXR 1000. So They have three races at Brands Hatch to try and rescue something of their season, which started off so brightly at Donington Park at the opening round, doing the double. I think it led them into a little bit of a false dawn, unfortunately. Whether it was the change of the tyres, where everybody had to use the 18 series Pirellis, whether it's something to do with the setup. I mean, Bradley was saying on the TV that it wasn't particularly to do with any one end of the motorcycle. They were struggling with issues at the rear and at the front. So it seems that they're sort of all ends up trying to find a way around that Suzuki to make it back where it was at the start of the year.
I'm just wondering though, I don't know the level of support that Suzuki gets, but you've got OMG running the Suzuki as well. I don't know if there's like a little internal competition between those two teams to see who can get the most grace and favour from Suzuki next year.
That's going to be an interesting one, I think. The build-based Suzukis are going to finish further up in the championship than the OMG bikes. But there's a cheeky little tweet from OMG over the weekend saying there was a picture of one of their staff talking to one of the build-based Suzuki staff. And it was something along the lines of, here's build-based Suzuki looking to us to try and see how they can make their Suzuki quicker. So a little bit of banter between the two teams, and I know they get on well. So, yeah, it was one to make you smile on that front, that they aren't taking the rivalry too seriously. in that respect. But yeah, I'm sure there's certainly members of both teams have got an eye on that, you know, a factory deal should they should one come knocking for OMG, or should it be lost by the guys at Buildbase. So we shall wait and see over the winter on that one. Pete Hickman, he slowly but surely managing to get that BMW back up to speed again. They worked hard on it in between. I know there was things on social media that Pete had put up that they were back on the dyno pretty much straight after Alton Park, trying to iron out the issues that they've had with the S1000RR, the Smiths machine. So that he'd done also done a test at Cadwell Park to basically get the gremlins out of the bike as best they can. And that really showed through the two races. Didn't really show in qualifying, because Pete's not the best at qualifying anyway. He's never been a pole hound in that respect. So to miss out on the on Q3 for Hickey was a bit of a disappointment. But we did see both Hondas make it through into Q3. Along with Christian Eden, Josh Brooks, Tommy Bridewell recovering from his morning crash, Glenn Irwin, Leon Haslam, Tara McKenzie and Jake Dixon. Jake Dixon again into the mid-135s, hotly pursued by Tara McKenzie by 0.04 of a second at the end of the session. Leon Haslam rounding out the front row again into the 135s. That was the pace for qualifying. The pace in the race was going to be maybe mid-136s, somewhere around there. Glenn Irwin, after his announcement that he'd be riding for Pete Extensa's team, he was fourth. Tommy Bridewell, fifth. Good recovery for him. Josh Brooks rounding out the second row. Jason O'Halloran, unfortunately, he ran out of petrol with, I think, 3 minutes of the session to go. So that curtailed any efforts that he had to get a little bit further up the grid. But the two Hondas were over a second in arrears to Jake and Taran and Leon on the front row. So they had an awful lot of work to do, with Dan rounding out row three ahead of Sunday's two races.
You know, look at that. And I'm just looking at, Taran McKenzie. I think it was an outstanding qualifying lap from him as well. You know, you look back, Josh Brooks, you tend to think is the number one rider in that team.
Sure.
He was like, a good 0.7 back there as well. But Jake Dixon, I know it's on a Kawasaki, but you also know too, it's a fraction of the budget that the JD Speedfit Kawasaki team have. So it's an incredibly well prepared bike, and Jake Dixon really coming on song toward the end of the season. So a really, really impressive lap from him.
Without a doubt. You know, take nothing away from Lee Hardy and the team. Those guys have done an exceptional job this year, and not in any way, shape or form being disrespectful to them. For me, they've punched above their weight. You know, when you're looking at them taking the fight to, they're the only team that's consistently taken the fight to Leon all season. You know, if Leon's won, Jake's invariably been second, and vice versa. You know, they've had the most podiums between them all year, and it's only been the cameos from your likes of Josh Brooks and the odd one from Glenn Irwin. Tara McKenzie coming on strong later in the season. He sort of came to the fore from Silverstone onwards, really. And you know, for a small one-man team and on the budget that Lee Hardy has, I think they've had a phenomenal season. You know, even if they don't end up winning the championship, I think they can still look back with an awful lot of pride to what they've done. I mean, they showed flashes of it last season, but this season they've really, really stepped up. And the bike, on the whole, is the same as Leon's, has been immaculate all year, but it's still only machinery.
And this, I think, was also Jake's mission, really, for coming into Assen. We know that Haslam had not a huge, but a sizable lead, I guess, in the championship. But it was still a mathematical possibility. And Jake knew that the only way that he stood a chance of, winning this is putting Haslam under pressure, is coming out there swinging, putting in the fast laps and seeing if that could translate into the race as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's one to try with a rival, isn't it? Jake was saying that he's coming into the weekend with no pressure, but really there was, because he was under pressure to beat Leon. He knew that Leon was under pressure to beat him to extend the championship lead, but such was the points gap that there was going into Assen. There was definitely pressure on Jake, but maybe that was just how he was dealing with it. Neither of them really showed the pressure over the weekend. The intensity between the two, both through qualifying and in the opening race, was quite impressive to watch and really enjoyable, because they were both at the top of their game. They were both trying as hard as they possibly could, and both wanted, you know, showing their will to win. So, you know, nobody was handing it to one another to say, this is what we're going to do. But it was one that the tension wasn't shown on either of their faces, but the tension as the lights went out and throughout the races, as you knew, was, okay, well, this is going to be this many points and he's chasing him down and this is how this is going to be. And there wasn't an air of inevitability about it, to think, oh, you know, Leon's going to run away with this or Jake's going to run away with this.
Especially not race one, because I was thinking, you know, very early on, you know, Tara McKenzie, sitting on the grid, from what I understood, had gone with a soft rear, unlike yes. anybody else. So there was thinking, oh, there's a possibility here, you know, if he can get away and keep and use that soft rear, and it, you know, so it doesn't go at the end. There was a few other people in the mix there, definitely as potential spoilers for Haslam and Dixon to have to fight their way around.
Well, the resurgent Josh Brooks and a positive Pete Hickman for a start.
Yeah, for sure. I think Brooks in race one didn't necessarily have the best, but Tara McKenzie, I think he had a pretty great start and was early out into the lead in race one.
He was, and he tried to make the he tried to bolt away from the front, try and make the gap, and then as the SE0 would inevitably go off in the later stages of the race, then try and manage the gap that he would invariably try and open. Unfortunately, it didn't quite work out that well for the wee Scottish Englishman. The fact that he got reeled in by both Leon and Jake towards the end of the race meant that plan kind of didn't work. Shaky Byrne said he'd advised him on the grid before the race, and Taran actually corroborated that evidence. He said, yeah, he did tell me on the grid to go easy on the first few laps and let the tyre come in and then go later in the race when it said it's, you know, when you can still use it. And don't go off like a scalded cat because the tyre will drop. He said, yeah, it went in one ear and out the other. So maybe, you know, he's only young. He'll maybe not make that mistake again, because I think he really could have done some damage in the championship points for that and really could have brought home his first win. But unfortunately, there were lap records dropping left, right and centre. Peter Hickman was putting fastest lap record. Jake Dixon put one in. Leon Haslam put it in. And eventually Pete Hickman put the final fastest lap in, which gave him pole position for the second race. It's good to see Hickey back and smiling again. There's a thought that maybe he'd kind of lost his way a little bit on the short circuits that weren't fast and flowing like Assen and Silverstone, Thruxton, where he'd gone well previously in the year. But it was nice to see him back at the front and, you know, really putting his best spoiler hat on to make the championship as open as possible, despite the points gap, as we go into Brands Hatch in a couple of weeks' time.
I find it's always hard, you know, the championship and the racing is so tight, it's so close that, you know, the riders sometimes can just have, as he said, you know, some little gremlins, some little bugs that get into the bike during the year that takes them, you know, a race or two to find they've got an issue, to go back, figure it out, and then come back. So, yeah, it was really great to see that whatever work they'd done, it sounds like they had identified the issues, got rid of them, and he was able to be back running. Running up near the front with some fast laps. I kind of figured he'd go well. It's definitely the type of track I thought that would suit his style of riding, which is just throwing himself at the scenery at absolute top speed. So, and it was great to see, especially in race two as well, he really got in the mix.
Yeah, he did. And it helps certainly bring things on a bit for the racing. that it was nice, as we say, it was nice to see just somebody else up there rather than Dixon Haslam plus, as has been of late, Taron McKenzie in the main. So yeah, it's nice to have that extra bike, and good for Smith's BMW as well to show their level of competitiveness that is still where we thought it was, not the fact that you know they were kind of dropping away a little bit from the guys at the front.
And to be fair, I think actually in race one he was in there sort of third, but there was one point toward the end. I know if he was. I think he just got past Dixon into third, and then he had he missed a gear or something.
He
in
certainly
the corner,
did.
Just ran off, and then he couldn't quite get back on terms with them, unfortunately, in those last closing laps. So, Taron McKenzie, unfortunately, just went backwards in that last one or two lap as the tyre just dropped off. Haslam was able to squeeze past him, and Dixon as well. So by the time, they got to the line, Taron was back there in third, but I don't think Pete was too far behind him.
No, he wasn't. He put in a Herculean effort in the closing stages to try and bridge that gap back. Yeah, he missed the gear going past Taron McKenzie going into the slow left-hander at De Strubben. After the race, Jake was a little bit aggrieved at the pass that Pete had put on him, which I thought, for me, was a little bit sour grapes. Did you see the post-race interview?
I didn't see the post-race interview, but I must admit, I know, watching the race, I didn't see anything egregious. I didn't think that stood out.
Exactly that. I think because Jake's fighting for the championship and he can be a sensitive little soul at times, I think he made a little bit more of it than was necessary. He can be quite emotional at times for things like that. And I think he was a little bit out of order going on to the TV. But he's high on adrenaline. It's high on pressure. And that started to show a little bit of pressure. And the post-race interview that, he felt it cost him time and could have cost him a place. But for me, if Pete hadn't have missed the gear going into De Strubben, I think he would have finished third anyway. He clearly had the pace of the front four guys.
Yeah, it was a difficult track because a lot of the passes were coming into the Gert Timmins chicane under the braking. And most of the passes there, I have to say, I thought were pretty clean. If Pete is struggling to brake there, anybody's got a speed advantage elsewhere, he's just going to have to slide it up the inside elsewhere. That's all you can do. And then just hope you can defend and block into the chicane.
Well, the main two passing places, aren't they? Yeah. Turn one, turn four. Sometimes if you're brave enough, that little kink that takes you through, is it Hoghider? And then you come round to the Gert Timmer chicane, and that's the major place for it. But I don't think there's anything, certainly in the two superbike races, that amongst the front runners, that just it wasn't anything like MotoGP with Rossi and Marquez there. That's a fact. Yeah. There was none of those shenanigans, thankfully, at this point. Which, if just as a side note, guys that cut the chicane this weekend, whether it was, none of it was deliberate, obviously, but whether they were punted, however they did it, however it happened, they were docked 2.3 seconds, 2.7 seconds, something like that. That would mean that Valentino Rossi wouldn't have won that race at Assen. He'd have been docked the points because he cut the chicane. But that's contentious, and that's for another story.
Yeah, I know. That's a can of worms you don't want to reopen again.
I'm fishing. So anyway, that was the story of race one.
And I think it was really the story between those four people, Haslam, Dixon, McKenzie and Hickman. They seem to have just a pace above everybody else. Irwin finished back there in fifth, Tommy Bridewell in sixth, and they just seemed to form a second group of riders, I think.
Yeah, there was certainly a gap. There were gaps across, and they're the ones that they need to look at for next season. Hopefully those gaps will close a little bit. The 4 seconds back from Hickman to Irwin, then another 2 seconds, and then another 2 seconds. Over 18 laps of Assen, I would like to see maybe the top five or six be a little bit closer. But you can't have everything. We still had some fantastic racing and 0.086 between Haslam and Dixon at the line. As they came into the chicane for the final time, Leon just seemed to hook up really well from halfway around the back of the circuit and just get that 2 or 3 bike length gap that you need going into the Gert Timmer chicane so that the guy chasing you isn't close enough to make that lunge. And there wasn't any eccentric leg extensions. It was the usual dangle that he normally does. Didn't close the gap, didn't drop across Jake's line. He followed his standard line into the final chicane, and Jake just unfortunately wasn't close enough. He did try and gas it, whether he went back an extra gear to try and close the gap as it flew through the final chicane. But 0.086 of a second at the end of 18 laps, how close do you want it?
Yeah, exactly. No, it was and another masterful display by Haslam. I mean, he seemed to read the race perfectly. He didn't get too excited as Taran went away early, and he just seemed to pace himself perfectly throughout the race.
Yeah, he definitely had the pace of almost everybody in the field this weekend, as and when he wanted to. He really, they've got that bike absolutely where they want it. They've got Leon absolutely where he wants it, where he wants to be. So the pace is going to be there weekend in, weekend out. He hasn't got the best record at Brands Hatch. Two third places, I think, in the summer round there, around the GP circuit. That he still is yet to win at Brands Hatch GP, but I wouldn't put that past him for a week and a half's time, just to round out the season and winning at places that he's never won at before. But yeah, absolutely masterful from Leon Haslam. He's riding almost serenely. You know, you can see that he's trying. You know, he's not having it easy, especially with Jake Dixon snapping at your heels. But he never looked flustered. He never looked out of line. He wasn't leaving the big black lines everywhere. He was almost on rails, and he was comfortable. He had the gap and he had the pace. So really impressive to see Leon Haslam this weekend in the form that he's in, and to see Jake Dixon putting in that race as well. You know, it would have been easy for him to throw it down the road. He also looked very stable, very calm, but it was just fantastic racing between them. We'll just run through the results for race one, BSB at Assen. As we said, Leon Haslam, he took the win by 0.86 from Jake Dixon, Taran McKenzie. Peter Hickman, he took fourth place after missing the gear at Distrubben. Glenn Irwin, Tommy Bridewell in a decent sixth place for the Moto Rapido Ducati team, ahead of Jason O'Halloran, a still very sore Christian Iden for Tyco BMW in eighth place. Josh Brooks, a fairly distant ninth, 11 seconds behind the race winner. James Ellison, despite his change of suspension from K-Tech to Ohlins, could only manage 10th place ahead of Michael Laverty, Richard Cooper, Danny Buchan, Luke Mossy 14th, and Dan Linfoot rounding out the final points place ahead of Andrew Irwin. Bradley Ray out of the points, 25 seconds shy of the race winner. That really sums up the weekend for the Build-Based Suzuki team. Ahead of my own fair-weathered friend Josh Elliott on his debut for the OMG Racing Suzuki. Good weekend for him, getting used to the Suzuki without traction control and all the kit electronics that his stock bike has. He was 0.03 ahead of TT Maestro Dean Harrison, Sylvain Barrier, Fraser Rogers and Sean Winfield as the final finisher. We lost Aaron Zanotti, we lost Joe Francis, Martin Jessup, Gino Rea. He crashed on lap 5. Mason Law, he went out on lap 1.
And did you mention that Josh Elliott was riding the boss's bike?
No, I didn't mention that, but yeah, he was.
Okay, yeah, because I was thinking that's probably worth like slows you down by an extra half a second as the guy kind of gives you the evil eye as you roll out into pit lane.
Yeah, the Suzuki GSX-R1000 that Josh Elliott was riding, as Andrew quite rightly says, belongs to Alan Gardner, the G of OMG Racing. That was his own personal superbike that was World Superbike spec that had to be converted to BSB spec for this weekend. So yes, I think the don't you dare drop it, I think, was maybe uttered more than once across the weekend. But Alan knows what it's all about. He knows what this racing thing does. He's realistic in the fact that it's only tin and rubber, were his words at Silverstone when we were chatting about it. So, you know, he's quite pragmatic about it, but I'm sure there was a thing in the back of his mind that said, you bend it, you mend it.
Wow, it was great to see Josh getting the opportunity.
Yeah, it was good for him. He's had a good year for the guys, as we've covered on the show, with, you know, bringing in their first win. And I think the team have, they have desires to go on a two-man team next season for sure. So that'll be interesting for them. Hopefully Josh will be one of those riders. Hopefully Gino will be the other one. Again, it all remains to be seen throughout the off season, but I think this could well be a dress rehearsal for next season, should the budget be there for both riders.
Okay, so I guess with those results, then we can have a look at the grid for race two. I think we have Peter Hickman on pole next to Leon Haslam and Tara McKenzie on the front row. Jake Dixon, Tommy Bridewell and Glenn Irwin made up row two. Josh Brooks, Richard Cooper and Gino Rea was able to get onto row three, which was pretty good.
Yeah.
And then we had the Honda of Dan Linfoot, Christian Iden and Jason O'Halloran on the other Honda. Michael Laverty was back there on row five next to Luke Mossy and Danny Buchan. And then James Ellison, Andrew Irwin and Bradley Ray bringing up row six.
Which, you know, as 18th on the grid for Bradley Ray with a best lap from race one of 1:37.3. That's a struggle, isn't it? I mean, it's not a million miles off Peter Hickman's fastest lap. I mean, Hickey did a 1:36.4. So he's only .9, isn't it?
I know, but modern day VSB just, you know, that's what you get for .9. It's ridiculous.
.9 is now a yawning chasm. Especially when you go on race one lap times. If you see where Dan Linfoot finished and he ends up qualifying 10th, you know, it's a topsy-turvy grid for race two, but I do like it. I do prefer it to the World Superbike grid, that's for sure.
Well, and watching the two back-to-back, it was really, for me, interesting because World Superbike, very quickly, the whole field just strings out within almost two laps of kind of where the bikes are pretty much relative to each other performance-wise. You can really visually see the performance gap between the different bikes. You flick over to watch one of the BSB races, and three, four laps in, there's still huge, great trains of huddles of riders.
It's true.
And unfortunately, that kind of close performance, I think, caused us a bit of an issue at the beginning of race two.
Yeah, it was drama all the way, wasn't it, through race two? I mean, even from turn four, which is something that happened... happened off camera, I think, more than anything. Into turn three, Dean Harrison got in a little bit hot. He tagged the back of Josh Elliott, which damaged his exhaust and caused a vibration on the Suzuki. And it also took Michael Laverty out of the race as well, who was in sort of wrong place, wrong time kind of territory. So that the end of Michael Laverty's race, before they'd even got round onto the Wienschlang, onto the back straight, which is a shame for the Northern Irishman. He's had a difficult season, and I'd like to see Michael get one more crack at it on a decent machine and just see just exactly where he could finish and try and, you know, steal a showdown spot for next season. But that's going to be very, very difficult, as we'll come to, I'm sure, across the winter time for your ears to keep you just in the frame of mind for BSB across the winter time after the bike show. We might have a couple of weeks off at Christmas and then start building up again for testing. But we shall see as the darker nights unfold. But yeah, the drama, speaking of unfolding, the drama as we went into the Gert Timmer chicane for the first time. Peter Hickman had already made the whole shot. He was ahead of Jake Dixon and Josh Brooks. Leon Haslam had dropped in behind them in fourth place. Going through on the change of direction, Josh Brooks had a moment midway through the chicane, which caused Leon Haslam to roll off slightly, which caused an unsighted Dan Linfoot to run into the back of Leon Haslam, who unfortunately fell from his machine, and then the worst case scenario, falling into the middle of a pack of riders that are all pretty much unsighted through a fairly narrow ribbon of tarmac as they're accelerating off onto the start finish straight. Glenn Irwin unfortunately ran over a stricken Dan Linfoot. He had absolutely nowhere to go. Thankfully, the guys saw that unfolding behind them. The guys in immediate vicinity, Gino Rea ended up having a rodeo style with his bike. His hands and feet, the feet were off the pegs, hands were off the bars, but managed to regain control of the Suzuki. The more spectacular side was Tommy Bridwell. He collected Dan Linfoot's bike, and his Ducati Panigale wedged into Dan's bike.
Well, yeah, exactly. I saw the bike. Dan's bike's on its side.
Yeah, Bridwell, Dan's bike's on the
front
on its
wheel
side.
In between the tail unit and the back wheel.
Yeah.
So now his bike is just rigidly stood up, pushing Dan's bike along off the track, which then seems to catch fire.
It did.
As it then ran off the track.
And it was Tommy trying to get off his bike as he saw that Linfoot's bike was on fire, because first lap in, those bikes are full of fuel.
And we still had Dan in the middle of the track, down and injured as well. I noticed, like you mentioned too, a couple of riders like Glenn Irwin really, really quick to get a hand up to try and let other following riders know that there was something up, and to get their heads up and see what was ahead of them.
See, now I expected a red flag in that situation, but it never came. And I know quite a few riders expected the red flag to come out, and they raised their hands past the incident.
I saw that too, and there was a minute where I was waiting to see what happened. It struck me that there was no debris on track. Dan seemed to get him side to the side, and he would have been on the pit lane wall side.
Yes.
And so I think he pretty quickly had marshals and doctors with him. I think they put the safety car out to slow the bikes down while the medics
assessed it.
Saw Dan, and you know, assessed presumably too as well, because they had to treat the fire. I mean, they were hopping around with extinguishers on Linfoot's bike, but presumably to see if there was any contamination on the track,
which thankfully there wasn't, which it was a surprise after the bikes that went down.
So my sense was the location where you're sort of coming out of the you know, it's a fairly chicane, the bikes are slowed down, they're accelerating, they're under probably waved yellows. At that point,
definitely,
you know, with the safety car, I think the bigger issue seemed to be a little bit later when the safety car came in and seemed to leave its lights going off really, really late, which caught some riders out.
That was certainly a bone of contention over the weekend, one that Shane Byrne picked up on, which an interesting turnaround on Shane Byrne for the weekend. For that, he was quite vehement. Is that the right word? I don't know. He was quite strong in his opinions when he was talking about the safety car. And then when they came back after they'd had a break, or it was the end of the race, something had been said to Shane Byrne, because he changed his tact. He's changed his tone completely. Mm-hmm. He still said that the lights were late, but he'd had a dig at race direction. And race direction have the feed for, also have, I think, access to the TV feed. And I think somebody had a quiet word in Shane Byrne's ear that he was a little bit harsh on race direction for the safety car lights going off.
Mm-hmm.
Because he made an immediate, not an apology, but not a retraction, but he really flowered it around compared to what he'd said previously. And this is something where, as far as the TV goes, is something that he'll learn as time goes on. Personally, I don't want him to lose that. If he feels that way, I want to hear that.
In my mind, he would have been talking about that from a rider's perspective. I mean, you know, any anger and frustration, you know, it's if he's still out there on track. And
exactly,
he
that
knows what he wants and what he expects as a championship challenging rider.
Sure.
You know, and he, you know, I think riders by their very nature are very demanding on themselves, and therefore they become very demanding of everything and everyone around them.
Oh, without a doubt.
As well. So, yeah, you're right. I agree with you. You know, you've got the Matt Roberts, you've got the sort of more retired people who can do the sort of more, you know, flowery stuff. I want that insight into
100%.
How a racer thinks, that sort of, you know, that aggressive, and understand that things are seen through that light and processed through that filter.
After all these years of doing it, Witt's really good at it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, James Hayden is a perennial fence sitter.
A lot of fence sitting.
Does an awful lot of fence. Great guy, good on the commentary, good on the TV, excellent at what he does. But he is, from an opinion perspective, he's a bit of a fence sitter. Whereas Shakey went straight in and was like, no, this is... And I 100% agree with him. Those lights went out too late. I thought they had to go out as it crossed the line, the lap that they were that it comes in. So they have a whole lap to warm the tyres up to know to get ready.
Yeah.
But I don't think the lights went off until the back straight.
Yeah, it was pretty last minute because even the commentators got caught out. In some respects, you could say, I think, that Shakey's vindicated, because what happened after the safety car came in, and arguably a lot of the arguably less experienced riders didn't have enough time to put heat into the tyres.
Especially the soft that loses heat quite quickly, which is what Tyrann McKenzie was on. So as he jumped on the gas on the left-hand side of the tyre, it threw him straight out the front door.
Yeah, I mean, it was bad enough, the crash, but then seeing where that left him on the track... with a whole fleet, a whole pack of riders coming through completely unsighted on him. He was really, really lucky.
He really was.
To not be hit, and some pretty fast foot movement to miss. Dean Harrison?
Yeah, exactly that.
That was close.
That could have been, that really, he would have felt Dean pass him. He was, you know, it can't have been. And if you haven't seen it, dear listeners, it's no exaggeration to say that Dean Harrison missed Tyrann McKenzie by no more than 2 centimetres.
It looked close, and then they picked a different camera angle, so from behind looking up the straight, and you suddenly realise actually how close it was.
Yeah, it wasn't the TV angle foreshortening things. He literally grazed his leathers.
That was a really scary moment, and happily and miraculously the pack cleared off, and Tyrann was just left stood there in the middle of the track thinking, shit.
Yeah, I think he went off to be sick somewhere after that. I think that was a very, very scary incident for him, especially for, you know, to be stood in the middle. It's the worst case scenario, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you're injured in the middle of the track, there isn't a lot you can do. But if you're not injured and you stand up and you're watching these bikes barreling towards you, thinking, shit, do I move or do I let them move?
And there's a limit to how quickly you can get the bike to react.
That's right. So what do you do? Do you move out the way and hope that they can carry on their trajectory, or do you expect them to move and miss you all in the space of a half a second?
With the restart then, so we had Hickman back into the lead. Dixon Brooks was up there in third, I think. Haslam was sat in a good watching sort of fourth. Cooper on the Suzuki up there, I think, in fifth. Who else? We had Iden and Allison and Andy Irwin as well.
Yeah, the incident, because again, a lot of people had gotten caught up in it, and Josh Elliott was another one who'd been pushed onto the side, and Jason O'Halloran. A lot of guys from the first incident and the second incident lost an awful lot of time, including Leon Haslam, who I think he dropped back to fourth or fifth.
Yeah, I think he was fourth by about lap 10.
And some of the guys were expecting it to be red flagged, and it wasn't, and some gunned it and carried on, you know, almost play to the whistle kind of effect. Yeah. You know, I was chatting to Jules Elliott, Josh's dad, yesterday evening, and he said, you know, you've got to play to the flags. You ride to what the flags say. If the flags are green, then you just race. You know, you can't preempt a red flag.
Well, there's a whole team of people who are making that decision with all the information they have available to them. You know, you can't make that unilaterally. Like you say, you just got to...
No, but the amount of riders that were there with their arms up thinking it was going to be stopped...
Yeah.
Especially after the first incident, really shuffled the pack around.
And actually, even by that time, you know, we got up to by a lap 10, and even then the drama wasn't complete, because lap 10, Dixon sat there in second, hoping to get another win to carry on his championship run there. Unfortunately, he had an issue and ended up having to pull up and cruise. I think it was an engine issue, but I didn't see any smoke or anything. He seemed to be able to cruise back to the pits. Some issue there. I mean, he was gutted when that happened.
Oh, as you would expect, something out of his control. I mean, if he crashes and it was his own fault, then so be it. You know, he has no one else to blame but himself. But when it's extraneous circumstances, something that he has no control over whatsoever, then, yeah, the most gutting of circumstances that you could possibly have, really, when you have no control over the situation whatsoever. He rolled back into the pits, and you know the TV cameras were there to meet him coming in. jumped off the bike, screamed at the bike, and just shouted at the team, "It shit itself." Now, whether that was the gearbox, whether, you know, it could have been something along those, it could have been a gearbox issue, because, as you say, the bike was clearly still running and there was no smoke or any sign of fluid, anything to say that the engine had let go in any particular way. The one thing I thought is if they'd tried to get the most power possible out of that engine to keep it, you know, on the coattails of Leon, if they turned the power up to 100% and the bike had, you know, hadn't been strong enough to take it, I wonder if that was maybe something that they'd done. But that was just me thinking out loud, you know, because they run these bikes at, you know, they can run them at 85, 90, 95%, because you're not going to get 100% of the power down at somewhere like Alton Park. So I wonder if they'd turned it up to, not in a Spinal Tap sense of turning it up to 11, but if they turned it up to 10 and it just was a little bit too much for the engine. But the engines were all sealed after the showdown started anyway. So it's a difficult one. It's a hard one to take for Jake. And, you know, he knew that Leon was going to finish the race. Wherever he was going to finish, he was going to extend the points gap even further. For me, as we go through the results and as we run out the race, Pete Hickman was leading. He was then usurped by Josh Brooks, I think, a couple of laps later after Jake had pulled into the pits. Who were then all being chased down by Leon Haslam, who was riding one of the, you know, I wouldn't say it was quite the race of his life, but from the gap that he had to make up and then to make the clean passes on both Hickey and Josh, and then to hold that that advantage that he eked out, which was only a couple of bike lengths from Josh Brooks and subsequently from Peter Hickman, you know, I think that was one of the best weekends that I've seen Leon Haslam ride. He took the flag ahead of Josh Brooks by only 1.3 seconds. So it was nothing at the flag. Hickey was a further 0.8 back ahead of Glenn Irwin, Richard Cooper, Andrew Irwin, Brad Ray getting a little bit of solace from the weekend in 7th place, James Ellison in 8th, Danny Buchan in 9th, Christian Idden in 10th, Jason O'Halloran after going off track to avoid Bridewell and his sister Suzuki, he recovered to 11th place, Dean Harrison in 12th, Barrier 13th, Fraser Rogers 14th, Luke Mossy still struggling, again, because he also was caught up, as was Gino Rea, Joe Francis 17th, Sean Winfield 18th, and Aaron Zanotti in 19th place. What a weekend for Leon Haslam, seriously. Ended up with the fastest lap of the race in race two. Again, an early 1:36, which is, you know, phenomenal pace to hold for a race. Just nothing that Jake Dixon could do for the issues that he had. And it means now that we go to Brands Hatch with Leon Haslam needing 14 points more than Jake Dixon, which is doable on the Saturday. It's a triple header, so there's 75 points up for grabs at Brands Hatch a week on Saturday and Sunday. 14 points. For me, I know that it's racing and anything can happen, expect the unexpected and all that kind of thing. For me, it's all over.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, Liam can ride a decent race at Brands. You know, he can, if he needs to, he can just have the points finishes, the pressure's on everyone else. I mean, I do remember that disaster he had, you know, last year at the last round. But, you know, surely that can't happen to the same person 2 years running. I mean, that's just with the season that he's had and the fact that he went into Assen, a place that he's not traditionally gone well at as well, and just cleaned up in a really, really mature way. I mean, it was just, you know, you saw he had the pace. He used it exactly when he needed to. He never seemed to have any struggle to get past people when he needed to fight his way to the front in those last few rounds. I mean, the last race was really between those top three, Haslam, Brooks and Hickman. I mean, you know, Irwin in fourth, some 8 seconds behind. So, you know, Haslam stayed with the best and just did what he needed to do to just take it for the win.
Which is exactly what he needs to do at Brands Hatch. I don't see him finishing off the podium. You know, he's not going to ride around in 5th, 6th, 7th place or anything like that, because that can have a detrimental effect. He'll focus and he'll push for the wins. And I haven't looked at the points table to work it out, but I would dare to suggest that if the same thing happened as happened last year, which, touch wood, and God forbid it won't, and I'm not putting any mockers on it, this is just as a what if or a what could have been. Should that happen this year, I believe the points gap is enough that he would still win the championship.
Yeah, I think right now the points gap is like 61 points.
61 points, exactly that. 14 points if Leon wins and Jake finishes fifth or below, then that's the championship done on the Saturday.
I think maybe the other interesting things we've talked about is the Riders' Cup. Jason O'Halloran there on 152, second now after a good result, at least in the first race. Tara McKenzie, 147. So, you know, he's not too far behind.
That's tightening up well, isn't it?
Yeah, Iden as well. You know, he's there potentially as well. You know, that, you know, as he continues his recovery physically, you know, I think it could be, you know, really between those three people.
As it stands, the British Superbike Series is alive and well. It looks like it's in the hands of Leon Haslam for 2018 before he heads off into World Superbikes for 2019 to partner Jonathan Ray. So we will see what comes in a week and a half's time. I'll be back on the show with you then, mate. I shall be available. I think I'm on days, so I should be doing 12-hour days and up early in the morning. So if you can get some semblance of, you don't get some semblance of sensibility out of me anyway, normally, but I just waffle on and pretend that I think that I know what I'm talking about.
Yep. Yeah, it's the usual thing. A few drinks, some Ovaltine and some Viagra, put the microphone in front of you and just off you go.
The only thing Viagra does is stop me rolling out of bed.
So this weekend we'll have MotoGP in Thailand at the Chang International Circuit. And then, as you said, the weekend after we'll have World Superbikes in Argentina. And we'll have the last round of British Superbikes at the Triple Header at Brands Hatch. I'm really looking forward to that, to see that close out the season. We'll probably have some more gossip as well as to who fits in where for the 2019 season
I should say
in
so.
British Superbikes. And that's kind of half the fun. We've been waffling on a lot about World Superbikes. You can always email us your thoughts and suggestions on what you think they should do. If we made you head of Dorna, what would you do with World Superbikes? Drop us a line. You can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. You can also leave some comments on Facebook, facebook.com/motopod. And also we're on Twitter as well at @moto_pod.
Yeah.
Dave, thank you very much indeed for your time this evening. Great to catch up with you as always. Like I say, it was a pretty spectacular BSB race and looking forward to the next one.
I look forward to it, and I look forward to joining you back on the show then. Thank you very much as always. Thank you for listening, everyone, and we'll catch you soon.
Yep. Cheers, everyone. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.